Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's March 3rd, 2019. Welcome to episode 189 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now. And my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, and increasingly lemons. So, I am Paul Hagstrom in Boston. I am joined today by Carrington Vanston in Toronto. How are you?
I'm excellent, and I've brought the lemons. Big lemons.
Excellent. And Earl Evans in Portland. How are you?
Well, I'm doing okay. I'm still kind of irritated that the other show participants have nixed my idea of having a laugh track on RCR. I thought it was a great idea.
No,
but...
no, we enabled the laugh track, and as soon as you say something funny, it's going to kick right in.
That's right.
We enabled it every time you're on the show. You just didn't notice.
Oh, man.
Somehow reminds me of something that they did. I think it might have been a recurring thing on Car Talk, but at least it came up occasionally on, they spend, like, whatever, this show is purportedly about, like, fixing cars or whatever, and, you know, mainly it's about, like, having conversations with people on the phone, and about 30% of the entire show is just these guys laughing.
Yes, and somehow it's still really entertaining.
And apparently it is, it soothes cows. So cows are calmed by the laughing of the car talk.
I've heard that.
Okay, cool. How can you tell that a cow is soothed? Well, like, cows look kind of calm on their own. Like, you look at a cow and you just don't think, whoa, you're really buzzing.
Yeah, I suspect it would take a cow expert and a car expert.
That's a Venn diagram without a lot of overlap, I think.
The cow and car experts.
The cow experts, yeah. And the car experts.
Yeah, and right, exactly. Anyway, yes, next time we'll work on the laugh track.
Neil writes the following. I decided to try an experiment. I recorded your show, went to the farm, and played the recording to the sheep. Here's my observation.
Go ahead.
It's your laughter. There was absolutely no notice by the sheep when you were analyzing a car problem. Of course not. Sheep don't drive. Right? But as soon as a quip or one-liner or a clever retort was given, a little laughter would ensue. That laughter would perk up those little sheep ears, and they would approach the speaker and start bleeding back. That's from Neil.
I love it.
So I am once again host, and the host's topic that we thought we would work today would be
cows.
Cows, right? And lemons and other agricultural
things. I thought
it
was potatoes. It was potatoes, wasn't it?
Okay, so
show's off the rails already.
It doesn't take long. I don't know how long has it been going, but so one of the things that I was going to put in the news had to do with new versions of there's actually a number of different new versions of Apple system software. There's a new extension for AppleWorks and things, and I thought, you know, this actually it might be sort of interesting to talk about kind of like these modern updates to operating systems that have long, you know, ceased official development. So the ones I know are the Apple ones. So there have been relatively recent updates to ProDOS, to GSOS, to, you know, the Apple DOS. And we can talk about those a bit. But, you know, I know that there are other things that I'm less aware of. You know, so Earl, you mentioned Sparta DOS, and there's OS 9 has still got a current life. So anyway, I don't have a particular angle exactly on this. It's just I thought it was interesting, and I thought I might see what people thought, what thoughts people had on these. Anyone want to start? Maybe Earl, you can start talking about SpartaDOS, since it, so it's not just all Apple all the time.
Well, sure. I mean, we'd need an Atari expert to talk in detail about it, but it's been around forever, and it still continues to get updates. And kind of like you said, revoking the end-of-life status on these operating systems. You know, I think there was a lull in between when 8-bits were new and now when 8-bits are cool, that there wasn't much going on, but all of a sudden there's just tons of going on, of stuff going on, and you see it in the system software. I'm particularly impressed by the Apple stuff, to be honest with you. I think new versions of those classic operating systems is such a cool idea. And I think after all these years, having had time to think about where could we polish off some of the rough bits on this stuff, and then reverse engineering what you need to in order to then crank out an update, that's all just really exciting stuff. And, you know, we've got better technology now to do development, and so you combine that with decades of experience on these operating systems and knowing what sort of things you could make better. It's just really cool, and it's fun to see. And, you know, it's got to be a labor of love for the people who are doing this stuff, because obviously they're giving it away for free, like so much in the retro community. And that in and of itself is pretty cool, too, because when they originally made these operating systems, like I guess at least I could speak from the Apple perspective, they were making them to sell stuff. And now it's just a hobbyist effort. So... And I would be actually interested, and maybe some of this material is out on the internet, about how they reverse engineered it enough in order to be able to then turn around and update it. Because wouldn't you have to kind of know how the code works in order to patch in your updates?
Yeah, I mean, I guess one of the things that occurs to me with respect to the Apple stuff is that I think a lot of that is actually coming from source, you know, so decades on, source gets leaked, and, you know, like someone manages to get it to compile, at which point then you can start editing it and things like that. And so they do operate in this weird gray area. You know, I mean, people are doing it out of love and, you know, for free and all that stuff. But I could still see, you know, Apple coming down and saying, nope.
Well, you know, I think it's increasingly likely that Apple's going to start updating their 8-bit operating systems again. So...
yeah.
But some of that sweet, sweet ProDOS money.
Yeah. But I think Jack was saying sometime recently when he was talking about the next stuff, that there's quite possibly like code paths that he's following that were written, you know, at the origins of the next, you know, even today. And maybe that's not quite true with the Apple stuff, but quite possibly in like, you know, old Mac software, there's stuff hiding. And, you know, just the intellectual property rights. I think they would be within their rights to say, we're not going to develop it, but no one else can.
There is a lot of code stuff that you still follow, though. Like when you do, up until very recently, until I switched to like playing around with Swift, you do anything for iOS, there's all those NSs all over the place, and that's right. Next step. And so it's like it's in your face all the time.
Yeah. So far, it does seem like people have been pretty good about not grabbing rights on stuff that they no longer intend to distribute. But
When you brought up the topic, the first one that came to mind for me, if you're looking at operating system things, was the ProDOS. When version 2.03 came out in whatever, 92, 93, something like that. And then John Brooks surprises everybody like 30 something years later and says, hey, here's an update, version 2.4, which is like pretty crazy. Or I guess maybe it's 23 years update. I think he put it out for the 30th anniversary of the GS, but like that was amazing and shocking and surprising, came out of nowhere for me. So that's an example of this sort of thing. And also two episodes ago, we talked about like the oldest software we're still using. So when like, say a version of BBEdit comes out and that gets updated annually or so, and it's recognizably the same piece of software I've been using since the very beginning, and it just keeps coming out with new versions. So not just operating systems, but there's some software that just continually gets used and continually gets updated on the same operating system. And as for sort of deeper hardware stuff, the one that came to mind immediately for me was Quinn's ROM for the Apple IIc, or the IIc Plus rather, like to fix the thing I always disliked about the Apple IIc Plus, basically, was the booting to the faster speed. I'm like, that's not useful for games, but it actually fixes the – it corrects the startup chime and – or the beep, rather. And so we can say nice things about it because she's not on the episode this time. And it's like, that's amazing. Like, that's just a crazy bit of – I remember her Kansas Fest presentation about how you have to dive in. And it's like, okay, now we basically are going to the underside, up to the top side, like, and threading the needle through this double-sided code. It's just insanity. So that's amazing stuff. So it's really cool when these things come out. But often it's somebody – going to incredible lengths to jump through the constraints, jump through the hoops that are set down from something literally decades before, and to keep that, because you can't just come out with a new version that is not in any way compatible with older stuff, because the whole point of legacy things is to use the old things. So a new operating system for the Apple II or the Tandy Coco nowadays that's not compatible with any other software would probably have a limited market, even compared to the limited market of current, like, say, Coco users. So there's some real constraints there. So it's pretty amazing when somebody fixes things or comes out with a new version of an OS or a ROM or an app or whatever.
Yeah, I think for example, I think there are, now, of course, I don't know the names of any of these things, but I think there's a Unix-like shell thing that you can get for the Apple II and probably other 6502 based things.
It should be called Tunix.
Ah.
Yeah, the one for the Commodore, I think, is called Linux.
Nice. but I mean, like, so these things, if they didn't have applicability, like, they're sort of novelties in a way that, you know, might be interesting to try, but one wonders.
one
if
wonders.
If there's, you know, if you can do anything with them, you know, so the ProDOS enhancements, those were, and I'm pretty sure these were done with the aid of the source code. But, and, you know, when Apple wrote it, Apple was in a hurry. You know, I mean, so they couldn't just, like, dink around with this for a couple of years. They needed to get it out, and so and they weren't very backward facing. And so there's certain things that it was just not compatible with in the earlier Apple II line. That it could have been. I mean, like, as I understand it, the things in ProDOS that required the updated opcodes and things weren't that hard to rewrite. Or, I mean, like, at least it was possible to rewrite them. But Apple didn't want to spend time doing that. So that's one of the things that the update to ProDOS does, is it backs up compatibility all the way back to, like, the original Apple IIs if they have enough memory and stuff like that. And, you know, updating the driver, like the clock driver to be able to work into the future and stuff. So
ProDOS still seems kind of newfangled to me, though. I've yet to actually fully embrace it.
Yep, agreed.
That's a really cool point, though, about time pressure, because you're right. When they were originally cranking these things out, they, you know, they're paying programmers big bucks and they're on the clock. And now we have the luxury of time to take a look at the stuff, you know, fix it up, it's a hobby thing. So take as long as you want and then come out with something that, you know, like the phrase I mentioned earlier, is a labor of love, and actually had the time to have the polish on it.
The luxury of time to do hobbies. Who are you? Yeah. What?
Oh, I was speaking in the royal we.
Because I wish I was that guy.
Not personally.
So, yeah, maybe it is also worth, since I think we haven't actually talked about it as an item, the DOS 4.1 release, which is an extension of DOS 3.3, which is the last major, so for those who are not intimately familiar with this, DOS 3.3 was essentially the basic operating system that the Apple II used, and then in the Apple IIe era, ProDOS came along. So that was, ProDOS was sort of like a reworking of the Apple III operating system for the Apple II. And so Carrington and I think ProDOS is newfangled.
I do indeed.
DOS 3.3 is the way to go with its flat directories and all that. 30-character file names.
Wait,
30
DOS
characters,
3,
though.
Luxury.
Yeah. But so DOS 4.1 is a new version of that line. It's written by Wallen Philip Vrbanchik, I guess. And who was a retired Raytheon engineer and former Sierra Online developer. And this one, as I understand it, this actually is kind of breaking compatibility somewhat. So it changes a little bit about how the directory is stored on the disks and stuff. So that's interesting in and of itself, that the emulators had to add support for it. It's possible that they just had to add support for how to read the, you know, how to sort of automatically read the directories on the disks. You know, maybe they had that built in for DOS 3.3. I'm not sure exactly, but there's a little list on the Call Apple announcement of the emulators that support it. And Call Apple itself is publishing a DOS 4.1 manual, actually, if you want a physical thing. So it's I really don't know what's going to happen with that, but I think part of this is why it seemed like an interesting topic, because this does feel like it's almost breaking away too much to get adoption. So I kind of wonder what's going to happen with it.
Agreed.
So I guess I had, you know, just to spread the platforms out a little bit, I was wondering if, like, OS 9 is one sort of similar thing that people have been working on, the 6809 operating system that I think still continues to this day. I have no experience with it. I just know that, you know, people do it. We have a link to the Nitros 9 project. Do either of you have any experience with any editions of this operating system?
I have experience with the original OS 9 operating system. I got that. I remember liking it and thinking it looked better once I switched over to Mac OS 10 and Aqua and its slowness. And I was like, oh, I didn't appreciate what I had. But I kind of preferred 8 to 9, and I kind of preferred 7 to 8. Frankly, I now reminisce for 6. And if the menus would stay down when I click them, I might just switch over today.
And I never had a computer with a 6809 in it, so I couldn't speak to that.
Yeah. I have hopes of someday playing around with a coprocessor card. I have at least one coprocessor, you know, like 6809 coprocessor card that goes in the Apple II. But, you know, there are so many projects. I think John Linville did a presentation about the 6809, is this right, Carrington, at Kansas Fest?
I think yes. In fact, I was just thinking the same thing, and think it was, you know, I think everything you said is correct. I'm going to back you. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Right.
Let me.
If you're wrong, email him.
Extract that as a ringtone. So it was interesting actually hearing about the 6809. People who use the 6809 are well familiar with this, but it's kind of like, it seems like the 6502 on steroids a bit. Like, it has many, many more little registers and addressing modes and things that you could use that I could totally see being useful. So someday. But.
Someday. With all that amazing time that Earl says we have.
Right. The leisurely hobby time.
From now on, I'm just going to, like, people say, you're late. I'm like, Earl says I've got time.
The other thing I put in this category was FreeDOS. I'm not sure. I mean, this is a long, long standing project, basically an open source reworking of DOS that people use when they feel bad about using IBM DOS. But
well, that's the thing. I think, well, and FreeDOS has continued to evolve with more advanced features. I think it's kind of a different animal in that it's a reimplementation that seeks to be API, you know, and disk format compatible, but it didn't originate from the original products like PCDOS or MS-DOS. You know, some of these other updates we were talking about on the Apple side are evolutions of the original products, whereas FreeDOS was, I think, nearly a clean room kind of open source, let's make something that's compatible with the DOS API, kind of like Wine is for Windows.
Yeah, it's interesting maybe actually MS-DOS and PC-DOS, lent themselves to that a little bit. Something like that for the Apple. I mean, just remembering, like, the clones for the Apple II and maybe even similarly for DOS. The problem with that machine is that everyone who wrote for it was, like, tinkering around with it, like, knew it super well and used all kinds of undocumented, entry points. So to try to make something API compatible, but yet not actually the same code is super, super hard. I mean, like, I'm sure I think Franklin tried to do this, right? That must have been a huge, terrible task. Kind of like Quinn's BPROM task, you know, like you have to maintain all of the entry points. So you have to squash your code in places that no one's looking.
Mm-hmm. I had a vague memory that in the mid 90s or so, there was another DOS like startup free thing to try to make a public domain DOS. And I've looked it up and found it's PDDOS, which turns out that is free DOS. It just changed its name. I'm like, oh, okay. Thought I found another one, but I did not.
Well, yeah, and I'm sure there are. I mean, like, you know, so it's possible that we have more than usual encouraged people to, you know, bang on their podcast devices in frustration. Because there are many, many things I'm sure we're not mentioning.
Mm-hmm.
But
no, I don't think that's a bang on the MP3 player moment. I think that's an email us and set us straight moment. And then we can talk about it on the next show.
Email us an audio clip of you banging your head against your MP3 player.
We'll play it. I promise.
We've been looking for a new theme song. Well, I've been looking for a new theme song. Right. It could be that.
Yeah. What's going on with that? Jack's supposed to be working on that.
Yeah, Jack.
Oh, well. All right. I think I'm ready to leave this now, unless anyone else wanted to put it.
Let's get to the lemons.
We're getting there. But first,
you can't have a show if you don't talk about lemons.
Listener feedback. I'll just run through some of the stuff that we got from listeners. So the ZX Spectrum Games Code Club book tweeted at us to suggest basically last time I think we talked about using retro computers in education and you know, like pros and cons and that kind of thing. And the tweet was basically, you know, how about including some Spectrum resources? And of course we weren't really trying to like exhaustively talk about people who use retro computing to teach kids programming. You know, there's the one book that kind of sparked the thought. But this is another. It turns out this is a book by Gary Plowman. Let's see if I can pull it up here. So ZX Spectrum Games Code Club, 20 fun games to code and learn.
Yeah, this looks awesome.
Yeah, no, it does look cool. It's it is a modern written book about, you know, learning to code using the ZX Spectrum platform. And I think, so it's a genre that there are tons of books in, right? I mean, like insofar as like in the 80s, you know, the bookshelves were full of like, here's how to program in AppleSoft or here's how to program on your DRS-80 or whatever, aimed at kids. But this one is this one has the sort of like the benefit of being in the modern era, you know. So knowing kind of what, and my impression is that it's kind of kid focused, but not entirely kid focused. I mean, like it's also for, you know, nostalgic adults to learn. But it's interesting to take a look at it. And actually, the author of the book and probably the author of the tweet has also written something. There's a blog entry called Why 80s Basics Still Matters, which I think is kind of like a, you know, sort of discussing why it's useful. Like, you know, what the point of using something like this book would be. So I have not read the book. I've only sort of seen that it exists.
I've only just heard about the book, and I think it looks amazing.
I think it's possible that, particularly if you're not actually using the keyboard, using a ZX Spectrum might actually be kind of a nice basic to use, because it does let you do, it lets you do things that are a little bit fancier than you know, AppleSoft does or Apple One Basic or whatever.
Right.
It's always nice to have, like, shocking nice colors. Continuing our discussion about SeaMonkey and Thunderbird and all these things, Beedrode wrote on Twitter, he had mentioned before that he used SeaMonkey currently, and he clarified that the reason he uses it isn't for the whole suite, but for specifically the WYSIWYG HTML editor that was a part of that, because it was one of the only ones that successfully imported Claris homepage pages, in which he had some prior investment. That's interesting. If you've been waiting with your Claris homepage pages unimported, this is a recommendation for you.
Okay. Yes, you, one listener.
Right. Blake wrote on Twitter to point out that Matt Frewer was on a short-lived sitcom called Doctor Doctor, which I had never heard of. And there's, I think the pilot episode is in bad quality on YouTube.
Mm-hmm. I had never heard of it either. He gave us the link to the pilot episode. I watched it. Now I want to seek out the whole darn thing. I would completely watch this sitcom. I would watch the heck out of it.
Yeah.
I'd never heard of it, though.
I had never heard of it.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like a sitcom. It seems very much like a sitcom.
I like a sitcom, though. I like a sit-down, just dumb, you know, multi-camera sitcom thing. I dig it. There aren't a lot of those anymore. They're more expensive than you know, reality TV. But I would watch this. I just haven't been able to find it yet.
It's very obscure. Yeah. I mean, I might have found a couple of episodes, but I mean, yeah, I bet this is going to be hard to locate. So anyway, but I certainly was never on my radar when it actually aired.
Nope. Never heard of it.
Okay. Francois on Facebook got an IBM 5322 from July 1981. And I'm just putting this out as a kind of a PSA or a, I don't know, request for information. If anyone knows anything about these machines, he's got a, when he starts it up, it does something probably like a RAM test and highlights number 19. He's wondering how to reset it. He doesn't really know where to go from there. So if anyone listening knows the IBM 5322 and knows how to use it, go to the Facebook page and start commenting on that thread.
5322? I don't know that
even,
at all.
Yeah,
what
even
is a 5322?
I don't know. There's pictures of it.
I'm going to Google.
It, yeah, that's a good idea.
Okay, so it's a System 32 thing with two vertical floppies built in. This is weird.
Yeah.
I don't know this computer.
I would have thought it might have been like a word processor or something. But mm-hmm.
Honestly, photos of it in real life just look like a 3D render. I'm not 100% convinced this exists.
That's right.
Even regular photos make this look like a bizarro render. It's an odd-looking computer. I like it. I like how the keyboard juts out from the front, but they left like an inch or so on the right. That's the keyboard. It's all offset so they could have a front-facing power button. It's some weird industrial design choices made here. Yep. I like it.
Yep. This must be 8-inch floppies, too.
At least.
You're right. Yeah. 8.5-inch, just to be irritating.
Maybe they're rectangular. That's my new favorite thing is rectangular floppies.
Right. Yes. Is that in here somewhere? Yeah. Speaking of that, Blake wrote on his Byteseller blog a look at the short-lived 3-inch compact floppy disk. We've talked about those, I guess, last time, maybe the time mm-hmm. before. Blake had a couple of those 3-inch floppies and opened them up and showed what was inside and why they are rectangular. The disk, of course, is not an oval or anything like that. It is.
Which would be great.
Yeah, that would be pretty cool, actually, if it just, like, it sort of flipped up on either end because it was wider than the... but no.
It'd be great if, like, you know how, like, on the Apple, there was spiral disk and stuff. But there should be spiral disk things, like that old put your pen in the wheel inside another wheel, and it should read the tracks that way and do a whole beautiful spirograph thing. Then I would adopt floppies again. Try to break that one, 4 a.m.
let's see. So Charles wrote with a good gift idea, the Altair Duino. And I'll put a link there. It's an Altair 8800 emulator. And the idea was so good that we actually already used it in episode 159.
I was going to say it seemed familiar. Right.
So, but as a reminder, we have not necessarily a better gift idea this time, but at any rate.
Well, the thing is about our gift guide, which is at rcrpodcast.com, it's not searchable. Like, it's all just images.
Yeah, I know.
And it's my fault. I'm the one who set up originally, and I don't know what I was thinking there. So, whoops. Whoops, yeah. I say.
No, I did, in fact, seriously, just scroll down looking at the pictures to see if one of them was the Altair Duino. Oh, well.
You guys need to remember, you can use Google to search any site, including ours. So just
not
site...
if there's no literally no text on it, Earl. It's a bunch of images where we put the text in the images.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
We hate people.
Then no, you can't search
it
that.
It's a hateful gift guide.
You got me.
When you like other people enough to give them gifts, but we dislike you so much to make it hard to find, you're looking for the RCR gift guide.
That's right. Okay, last thing. Bob over email, this was a little while ago, sent a link to the Commodore PET Mini, which is pretty cool. It is, essentially, it is a guide to producing a little 3D printed I want our pet Raspberry Pi case. And so the site includes instructions for building and 3D printing it, and there are some kits that are potentially available. I think you might be just expressing interest now rather than buying kits. But and even so, the kits are not going to include the 3D printing. You have to do or order the 3D printing yourself. But the result is really cool looking. So
the result is amazing looking. Like these little teeny tiny pets.
Yeah.
Pets are a great shape. I love the look of a pet. And even a tiny pet turns out still looks great.
Yeah. So anyway, take a look at that if you had not seen it on your social media feeds. And that, I think, will end the feedback, and we can move on to the items of interest and news.
I'm interested in lemons.
Many, many short items of interest and news.
No, I want to talk about lemons.
You want to talk about lemons?
Lemons. You guys talked about lemons last time. And how you can't power computers with lemons. And I'm still dubious because Quinn's not here to defend herself. See, she comes on and drops some actual science. And then she leaves. And we can be like, ignore the actual science and just say, oh, but what about this? What about a really big lemon? Charles Mangan, I remember on Twitter, he pointed out that the solution is often just a much bigger lemon. And
that's right. That's right. And actually, no, but I did miss one bit of feedback, which I guess I didn't put in the show notes. But having to do with the Commodore 630, the Commodore, having to do with the Quadra.
Speaking of lemons.
630.
Hey, now.
Karen, do you remember enough about this?
Oh, yeah, Quadra 630. I do. See, you guys were talking about the Quadra 630 and how it can't run the Apple IIe card. And I'm like, no, bang my head on the microphone. Yes,
so
it can.
You, like, some 2 months ago or something like that, did a hard sell on the Quadra 630.
And then you got one.
And I got one.
It showed up as a box of Smarties totally destroyed.
Right.
Sorry about that. Well, but, I don't know why I'm saying sorry. I'm a Canadian. Of course I'm saying sorry.
But one of the things that was, the selling points of it was that, it had all these cool features as well as being able to run the Apple IIe card. And then
right, and the DOS compatibility card. But Apple, in their own docs, will say specifically you cannot run it in the Quadra 630. But Apple is not telling the truth. Tisk, tisk, Apple, that is not accurate. See, the thing is, it shipped with an operating system, and that it was too late for the Apple IIe card because the Quadra 630 has clean ROMs, so 32-bit clean ROMs. What you need is something with the 24-bit ROMs, the aka the dirty ROMs. But if you run the right operating system, what you have to do is take a 630 and downgrade it to like system 7.5 or probably 7.1 as well. And then you have a control panel that will let you switch over to 24-bit addressing. And if you do that, yes, it changes your RAM ceiling, but you can run the Apple IIe card.
Right.
And you know who ran the Apple IIe card in his Quadra 630 CD? Mike McGuinness. So I'm pitting one Open Apple host against another. So Apple, Open Apple has scooped us on this, but in a weird sort of way.
Right. Was Quinn in the you can't do this camp? I don't remember.
No, almost certainly not. But yeah. She's not here to defend herself. So whatever. So I'm going to say, yes, she was. She vehemently said, absolutely.
Okay.
She bet her entire reputation on it. That's the way I remember it.
Okay. But yeah, so I was hoping to actually try that out today, and then I didn't, but I will try to do it between now and then. But we have Mike, on a forum somewhere saying, yeah, I know you say you can't do that, but that's just because Apple didn't want you to have to go back to using an old operating system.
There's a bunch of people online that show it, and I think I even found a YouTube video of it or whatever, but he's the most fun person to mention.
Yeah. Right. So I think it is true that the official Apple docs do not list. In fact, I think they explicitly
you actually say it doesn't. Right. Yeah, they say that this won't support it because it came out at roughly the same time, I think. But it says it doesn't support it.
Yeah.
But I say it does.
Yeah, that's the thing. It works.
I have no actual firsthand experience either. I'm saying this group of people, I'm taking that they're correct, whereas this other group of people, I'm saying they're wrong. Like, it's all technically secondhand to me, but I'm choosing to believe the people that agree with my statement.
Well,
welcome to the internet.
I have the theoretical capacity to have firsthand experience with this.
Do it.
In fact, I think I know where the 630 is, and I think they're visible through the side of one of my translucent boxes is an Apple IIe card.
So, hey, since I'm such a newbie on this, if you were to do this, where do you get the 5 1/4-inch floppy drive to do it? How do you do this? Like, you got the Apple IIe card in the 630, but you don't have a 5 1/4 drive, so kind of what good is it?
It's actually an external drive. Yeah, no, it is, because the IIe card comes with a Y cable, and that little Y cable plugs into the 2E card, and it splits off to give you both a joystick port and an Apple II, a Disk II port. And so you have an external Disk II or two of them that you can daisy chain them that plugs into that.
Beautiful.
A particular Disk II you either have to use or latest ones you can't use. So you can't just use any of them, but in the documents it says like you got to use this model or whatever. So
I got one documents about what you can use.
Yes, this one we trust. It's all very particular.
So the ones he could use, would that be like the Unidisc or the Duodisc?
Yeah.
I'm going to say yes.
Okay.
Or maybe not. Yes. I'm going to say yes. I'm going to say a lot of things.
Yeah. It's not the, it's not the actual Disk II. It's the, but it's a,
don't use the Disk II for your Disk II.
But yeah, the
have I made this clear?
Anything that has the kind of the DB19 I think connector is a candidate. I didn't know actually about the possibility that some later drives might not work. That's not cool.
It's only because it's or maybe it's earlier drives. I just know on the in the docs because I have a boxed one, and the docs that came with it talk about it. I think it lists model numbers or whatever. So my memory of it is that I haven't looked at it in a long time, but my memory was it said specifically use this or don't use this, something like that.
Right. It is pretty funny, though, relying on that page and discounting the other page.
Totally.
But whatever. Yes, so that's where we currently stand on the Apple IIe card
situation. It can
situation.
Be run in the 630 CD, and it can be run by Lemons.
Yes, right. I think that's exactly where we are.
That's totally what we say.
Given the sufficient quantity of Lemons. See, exactly. I think there was something about like, you know, current versus voltage, you know, that kind of thing.
Well,
so,
just like if you have enough lemons in series, you can increase your voltage. But I don't know if you've read my monograph on the relationship between juiciness and amperage, but what you need is just a sufficiently large. As Archimedes said, give me a big enough lemon and I can power the world. That's a direct quote, although he said it in Greek, I think so. But whatever, whatever. Totally okay.
Yeah,
I read that on
the internet.
How about this? What if you have a really big wheel that turns a generator, and the wheel is powered by rabbits? And what do rabbits like to eat? Oh, they eat lemons. So by extension, the lemon is actually, at the end of the day, powering the generator, which could power the Apple IIe. Oh, yeah, that's what I'm saying. Okay. A wheel/rabbit/lemon-powered system is totally capable of running an Apple IIe, obviously.
Perfect. Well, it is. I've done it. I'm really unhappy that I got rid of mine. But
your rabbit lemon wheel thing?
Exactly. Yeah. It just took up too much room. And, you know, rabbits, they make a lot of waste, too.
It takes a lot less room
too,
than this giant lemon I was proposing originally. It's much more convenient.
All right. Anyway, I think now we can move to the items of interest and news. But in case someone is just for some reason listening to 189 and not the previous episode, go back and listen to Quinn's story about the lemons in the previous episode.
We get actual science.
Yeah. But okay, tell us about the Muppets.
I will tell you about the Muppets. Yes, so I got first. So my links, I got a few links this time, and they're all relatively short. But this first one is not new, but it was new to me. And I don't think we've spoken about them before on previous shows. So there you go. Something that's come up in the last few weeks for me, which is Jim Henson Technology Films. And I love these. And they are mostly from 1963. So we've got this one called, they're all on YouTube. There's one called Paperwork Explosion, which is a 1963 film about the MTST word processor. IBM said, hey, there's going to be like word processors are exciting and new. And Jim Henson made a film about it. Now, this one doesn't have Muppets. Most of the other ones I'm going to talk about have Muppets involved, which is mostly better, but it does have crazy early 1963-ness. So the 60s was a weird time for film. Like things will be put in a film, even like this, like a technology film in 1960s that you would really only use in bizarre horror movies nowadays. It's odd, the experimental stuff that people would just think was okay. So in this one, it goes to this weird place where it starts to rapidly cycle between a bunch of different people, all in their business suits, and there's guys and there's girls and a nice sort of a diverse bunch of people, but they're all, you know, IBM people, and they're staring at the screen directly in extreme close-up saying, machines should work, people should think. And then it starts to cycle between them. You have like one person saying, machines should work. And then the second person says, people should think, machines should work, people should. And it just like, for like a good minute, just cycles quickly through all these people shouting this at you. It's bizarre. It's right out of 1984. So if you want to see a Jim Henson paperwork explosion film, we'll have a link to that one. He also in 1963 did some films for a Bell Data Communications seminar, and there's two films, one of which was thought to be lost for ages and was relatively recently refound. So there's one called Robot, which is the first of them, and one called Charlie Magnetico. These ones feature Muppets, and they're like super early Muppets. So if you want to see Muppets from the 1960s, it's really neat. And so, again, bizarre. These exist also in the AT&T archives, which is an amazing site that brings together like a huge number of old AT&T and technology films, including these, but the site requires Flash. So you have to use Chrome or somehow put like, I'm like, come on. So I'm linking to them, or we'll have links to the YouTube ones instead. Although we should also link to the AT&T archives because it's great. And that's where I actually found these things. But then I scurry over to YouTube and search for them and watch them there. The AT&T archives has a YouTube channel. So they put their most of their films on YouTube as well. And frankly, it's a more convenient place to watch them, but there's not everything's there and it's less nice to search. And then we got Rolf the dog meets an IBM typewriter. So there were these IBM films, really early ones, where it was like introduction films where like somebody would meet a thing or talk about it. And so Rolf the dog, who goes as Ralph Cameron Swayze in this. And I was like, or Ralph Cameron Swayze. And I was like, is that his full name? Like, what? Turns out John Cameron Swayze was a really famous guy in the 1950s that I had not heard of. And he was in some TV shows and films, but mostly famous for being a product announcer. So I guess in 1963, if you made a joke on his name, everybody would know what you're talking about. I had to Google it. So it's not Ralph's real name, but you can see him hanging out with a typewriter and being a Jim Henson film. Goes to weird places. Like he says, we're going to put this typewriter and we're going to show how robust it is by sticking it on a rocket and firing into space. And then it cuts to footage of a rocket exploding on the tarmac. And just, they say, well, here it is. We've fished out of the rubble and look, it still works. I'm like, what? Like, and so this is the IBM film. And like, it's all so strange. Then there's another one, Cookie Monster for IBM. So there's a Cookie Monster IBM. Like, they're great. They're delightful. They're funny. They were new to me, and I highly recommend them. Each one's just a couple of minutes long, and it's well worth sitting down to watch. With all the links and the links to the AT&T archives in the show notes. They brought me great joy.
Well, there goes my afternoon.
Yeah. Totally worth watching. These things are amazing. Jim Henson did some weird stuff in the 60s, man.
So did many other people, as I recall.
Yeah, I know I'd seen those before, but not any time recently. They're very bizarre. Yep. I do kind of wonder about that when... You know, like I'll come across some like trivia game or something like that in like old floppies. It's, I mean, already I'm not going to know the trivia that was, you know, was sort of pertinent in 1983. But, you know, generations later who are playing this on the Internet Archive, what are they going to make of that? These like, you know, whatever the top recording artists of 1981. I mean, even those you'd probably know, but more than like miscellaneous famous announcer who... then stopped being a famous announcer.
Yeah, who was
Ed
like,
McMahon,
I guess,
you know,
super...
For example,
yeah, and I know
people
going to
remember him?
We'll remember him later, yeah.
Okay, anyway. Speaking of the next thing, Earl?
The next thing. Well, retro computing is actually like the previous thing. And so if you want to participate in that, Retro Challenge 2019/03 is underway. They're off to the races. And it looks like another great one because there's, I count about 20 entrants so far. And, you know, you can still sign up. Lots of people sign up midway. Anyway, there's lots of fun stuff again going on with the different participants. New implementations of programming languages. You got some people creating games, some a little more complex. In one case, it's just a Pong game, which sounds really cool. New and improved hardware add-ons. And and, you know, and the catch-all and much more. So we'll have the link up in the show notes. It's fun to watch these things as they go along. Lots of the participants blog on a periodic basis. At least, you know, that's what you're supposed to do. And then, you know, you see some drop off along the way, like they're going, and then just they face plant. And, you know, that's kind of fun to watch, too. You know, you mm-hmm. can heckle them from the sidelines.
Feel superior.
Exactly. Even if you didn't do anything, they tried and you didn't, and you still heckled them, which, you know, no.
We encourage people.
Yeah, I know. So get in there, because for sure we won't make fun of you. Yeah, Retro Challenge is great. So we'll have the link, and, you know, go check out all of the people doing the fun stuff.
Retro Challenge is great. Yeah, I like about it is you challenge yourself. Like, you just come up with a thing that you want to do. It's not about beating other people or making everyone's trying to do the exact same thing. You can just say, I'm going to try to use a retro computer every day for the month or whatever. Like, you can absolutely set anything you want as a personal goal, and then that becomes your own retro challenge. And I really like that about the whole thing.
And that's why there's such a wide range of projects and activities that go into Retro Challenge, because, like you say, you're just challenging yourself, giving yourself an excuse to do something that you've wanted to do anyway with your retro computing hobby, and you just take this as an opportunity to do it in, like, add a social aspect to it. So it's just really awesome.
It actually sort of seems a little related to the whatever it is, the writing month.
Yeah, the NaNoWriMo. Yeah, very much so. I think that's a good comparison.
But just a motivator to just do it. And I'm kind of impressed at how many people are entered this time. It seems like a longer list than usual. I might be wrong, but it's still a lot of people to watch. And I kind of want to enter, even though it is already started. I mean, I can start
in.
To fail a little later.
Yeah, no.
Well, you were talking
in.
About wanting to catalog your stuff or box up your things. That could be a retro challenge. Like, I'm going to put something in a box and label it every day for the month. Bingo, retro challenge. Like, yep. It can really be that straightforward if somebody wants to join it.
All right, let's see. Am I next? I am next. I fished out the thing I'm going to talk about was actually something I'd originally been putting in part of the host topic, but we didn't really talk about it, so I want to actually just talk about it a little bit, which is the release of Timeout Edit Basic for AppleWorks 5.1. So this is basically, you know, it was just, it's as far as I know, just released today, although it's Timeout Edit Basic 5.4, so I'm not sure, you know, maybe I missed the first 5.3 releases, but it's written by Hugh Hood, and what it is basically a plugin for the AppleWorks program that allows you to edit basic programs. So it's sort of like a full screen editor for Basic. And I thought that was kind of cool just because it's, you know, it's a plugin for an old program, you know, that's just currently made. And it's the kind of thing, I mean, even, I don't know where it was mentioned, it might have been mentioned in Hugh's description of it, that it's actually a little bit weird that this didn't exist already, because the people who were responsible for this, you know, kind of like patching in these plugins to AppleWorks, Alan Bird specifically, also wrote a very good program editor so for AppleSoft. But at any rate, this what it basically just allows you to do is, if you are using AppleWorks, you can load a regular basic file, and it will convert it into text, basically, and then you can edit it, and then you can reintroduce it as basic by doing a specific thing that allows you to kind of read stuff in from a prompt as if it were being typed. So the round trip is fairly painless, and it does give you editing that's way better than what you would have natively. I never really used AppleWorks, but even the whole ecosystem of the timeouts plugins is interesting, because it was basically somebody kind of reverse engineered a way to patch in extra plugins. And then I think later it became somewhat more formalized, but there's a whole sort of like little industry of these timeout plugins.
Yeah, there are so many of them from Beagle Brothers, the timeout thing. I don't even know how many, but it seems like every time I turn around, there's another one. Mm-hmm. Or not a new one, but another one I hadn't heard of. This one I've turned around, there's a new one. that is more unique.
Yeah, at some point I want to use it. I know people who did use it liked it, you know, but I just never quite got around to it. So, Anyway, I thought it was kind of neat, and it does sort of fit in that theme of, you know, new extensions of long old, you know, old programs. All right, we're already back to Carrington. We're going very quickly through this cycle.
Yeah, come back to me. So this is the Atari Accountant is what I want to talk about, which is really the reason I think it's worth mentioning is not just for the thing itself, but for an example of a whole community of retro computing enthusiasts getting together and like doing a thing together that is just a huge success and awesome. So Bill Lang, who's the guy behind the Atari 8-bit ads stuff, mentioned the existence or seeming existence of a thing called the Atari Accountant. And then the baton got picked up by Kurt Vendel, who's a guy behind the Atari Museum, an archivist. He said, I think I have a copy of that. So he found one time by dumpster diving or something. And so he's got a copy. He sent it over to Kevin Savitz. So we've now mentioned Kevin on the show, as we want to do. And who
Bingo.
Scanned everything and got a bunch of input from people on the Atari Age forums, because everything's on Atari Age. And so they got together and they made all the discs and got everything scanned. And then a guy, Roland Vossenberg, collected everything together and stuck it on Atari Wiki. And like, it's just like, bingo, after almost 40 years, all these people kind of say, hey, I've got this, I've got that, I can do this. They all come together. And now it exists as a downloadable thing, fully documented. And that is pretty sweet. Would I want to now use the Atari Accountant? Probably not. Although that would be a pretty cool way to do your taxes now, I think. It's okay, right. Government here. I can give it to you only on this floppy version. But amazing. Like, it's an amazing example of kind of the power of a retro community. I liked it. I dug it very much. It's a heartwarming tale.
I think it's pretty cool that I was reading through the system requirements, and one of the things that it required was a dual drive, Atari 815 dual drive. These discs wouldn't work in any drive except the Atari 815. And of course, the 815 is like barely released. I mean, like, I'm not even sure. Like, as I think what we determined was that it, you know, it might have shown up as floor models in people's stores and things, but it really didn't go anywhere. So there are not many out there. I've seen one eBay auction for one, and I think we talked about this at some point, some in the past. But so even getting the hardware to run this thing is nearly impossible. I mean, I think it's been fixed so that it works on
other
drives now.
Yeah, exactly. It was nearly impossible at the time, and as well, because like the software was priced at $1,500 US. Like, that gave you the general accounting and inventory control and accounts receivable, whatever. So you're $1,500 for the software. You also had to have this Atari 815 drive, which was like a $1,500 drive. and Atari 850 interface module for it. And you have to have a particular printer. And so I think somebody did the math and said it's roughly a little under $5,000 at the time is what it would cost you to get this software working on your Atari, which is in 2019. Well, like, what is our year? 2019 is roughly $21,000. So imagine you're a home computer user and you want to just run some like a version of QuickBooks, and someone says, "Well, it'll cost you $21,000 to put together this stuff." So I can see why it wasn't hugely popular and was difficult to track down a version to archive, because that's crazy.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, what kind of business that might have that kind of money around would say, "What I want to do is do this on that game machine."
Exactly.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Let's see. So we seem to have a very unbalanced set of links here coming up here. Earl, do you want any of these things?
No. It's all cool.
Okay. So according to the show notes, I have the next one, and then Carrington has two more.
It's all coming up Carrington.
Perfect. I don't have a lot to say about my one here, but we were sent actually over email, so maybe this even counts as feedback. Tony mentioned that there is a Kickstarter. Right now, as we record, there are 13 days to go. It is well past its goal. It is for Spectrum Addict 2.5, The Lost Tapes, which is a feature-length documentary film about the Sinclair ZX Spectrum computer. And I think, this is actually, I think, a continuation of a previous documentary, but with some of the extra stuff that was shot for it, if I am remembering this right. I read this like 2 weeks ago now.
Well, that must be why it's called 2.5.
Yes. The original goal is for a 90-minute film, and if it hits 6,000 pounds, then it will go to 2 hours. Yes, it has, I don't know, how many pounds is $8,175? I think it must be close to reaching that second level. But anyway, if you're interested in this, I think the it looks to be pretty thorough by people who have done things like this before. So if you pledge 8 pounds or more, about US 11, it says, that will give you a DVD quality download of the film. An early bird delivery of that estimated August 2019.
My calculator says 81 something pounds is about 61 US.
Okay, so they made it.
That's crazy to me, because it doesn't seem that long ago that the pound was like 2.5-3 times what the dollar was. I remember traveling all the time, and it was just a crazily swung in the other direction.
Yeah, pound sterling is $1.33 US dollars, and that's true. That is quite a bit different than it was not that long ago.
Yeah. I mean, I live in Canada. Our dollar goes up and down compared to yours all the time. So I remember brief times where the Canadian dollar was more than US. Generally, we kind of like it to be around 75% or 75 cents because it really helps us to export into your country. So it's really good. We don't want our dollar to be like half of yours, but we want our dollar to be just enough less that we can sell you our stuff.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like about a decade ago when I went to live there briefly, that was pretty much right. Like, I was going to be rich, you know, because I was being paid in U.S. dollars, and then it went to parity right when I moved.
Aw.
So, stayed there when I was there, and then, you know, now we're back. So, Canada.
Ah, Canada.
Okay, anyway, read the Kickstarter. It seems, if you're at all interested in documentaries or ZX Spectra or anything like that, take a look at this. There is still time. And it is probably good, and it is not too expensive to get in, at least on the lowest level.
Good use of ZX Spectra.
Yes, thanks. Plurals are my specialty.
Plurals is not my specialty.
Carrington, you can... Oh, actually, you have a Spectrum thing, too.
Exactly. I figure I'll do my next two links in reverse order of the show notes, because I'll talk about this. So there has been a donation given to the Center for Computing History. We like the Center of Computing History because they spell center correctly. Go R-E. Anyway, they have been
Gore.
They have been given they have been given a Sinclair ZX Spectrum, but not any old Spectrum or Spectra. They have been given a prototype, and not even any old prototype, but what appears to be the very, very first. Like so it's always these arguments of which computer comes before what and what is the first of whatever. But this seems to be the absolutely first put together version of anything that would later become the ZX Spectrum. It was in the, it came from something called Nine Tails, which is a subcontracting company. They're the ones who made the basic ROM for the ZX80, the ZX81, and then later for the Spectrum. And this has just been in their possession all this time. They found it and they gifted it to the Center for Computing History. And it is really sweet. So if you want to see like a crazy early prototype, then this is it. And they have it and they're documenting it. And it's really neat. So if you're interested in the Spectrum, this is something to check out.
Cool.
Yeah. Need to see super early prototypes like that. Yeah, I've always been drawn to the Spectrum, but I don't really have experience with it. But someday, with all that sweet, sweet Earl time that we've been promised, then I will do that.
The check is definitely in the mail.
Excellent. And then the other link I have really quickly is to talk about a new game for the Apple II. So it's called the Sparkstone Tales of Florb. I don't know what that means, but whatever. Like the name. So it is a text adventure, but not in the type Infocom way, but in the choose your own adventure style. So you read the stuff and on the bottom will be a couple of choices. So it's a choice based game, but it's brand new. And how sweet is that? So I'll have a link to it. And so it's a new text adventure for the Apple II. Disk images are available for both 5.25 and 3.5. And it's a big enough game that actually takes 2 5.25-inch disk images, or you can play it on 3.5, and I think there's a special edition, like a boxed edition you can get. Oh yeah, so they're calling it the commemorative edition. Comes on actual floppies, and then you get like a little spell reference card or whatever to come with it. So that's pretty cool, and I think it's only like $5 or something, or $10, including shipping. So that's kind of sweet. So a new game for the Apple II. I applaud its existence, and we'll have a link to it in the show notes so you can play it yourself.
Yeah, this looks really cool. Copyright C 2019.
I know, right?
Cool. It comes with a little collectible wizard token.
Like everything about it. So it's awesome.
And I love some of these quotes. My second son has fallen ill with the sweating sickness. Having had teenagers, I can tell you that that's a thing. And then the next quote is, I no longer smell lemony fresh. And yes, that is the result. So this, this is really kind of cool. This sort of choice-based adventure game seems like it would have pros and cons versus the free text infocom style, right? I mean, it'd be a little easier to cycle through and play. You know, it'd probably like improve the speed of making your way through the game, but also maybe lack a little bit of the free world.
Mm-hmm. I think you lose agency, but you pick up the lack of hunt the verb.
Right. Exactly.
Like, I like the infocom style, but those are really difficult to implement. And regardless, like the forms take their form, and I'm sure this is the right. I really like that it exists. Something I didn't mention was there's links in on the site to download the disk images if you want, but there also is just a link to play it online. There's the Aero.tech online Apple IIe emulator in JavaScript, and so you just just click on the link, fires up. Bingo, here it is, and it looks like an Apple IIe on your screen, and just play it online. Similar to what you can do with the Internet Archive. It's just a different emulator, just in JavaScript, so it'll just run on anything. So you can just fire it up and play, and being a choice-based game, you don't even really have to worry too much about typing or how good the keyboard is, because you're just picking from two or three choices at the end of each screen.
Very cool.
I dig it. Yeah, well implemented. I like it. Way to launch a new game.
Nice.
And that's what I got.
Yeah, it actually hasn't been all that many years that we could say it's written in JavaScript, so it runs on anything.
Yes, true.
But at this point, yeah, it does seem to be true. You can play it on your watch, most likely, mm-hmm. because it is amazing that it is possible for like you have to reboot your watch. That just sounds even now nonsensical to me.
Mm-hmm. Sounds nonsensical to me to be promoting something in JavaScript. I railed against that for a long time. I've lost that battle, whatever. But
right.
I fought the fight.
Somewhere there's a funny sort of almost like meme style photo of the JavaScript reference with this big it's probably an O'Reilly book or something next to a smaller book that says JavaScript the good parts. And presumably they actually are both books that exist, but they're funny in juxtaposition. Anyway, all right. And with that, I think we can move on to a word from our sponsor.
You like brand new Lemon Pledge, the fresh, clean way to get the beauty of waxing with none of the work. As you dust, new from Johnson Wax.
Your child listens to the sounds of learning with My Talking Computer.
Find the four fish. Right.
Right.
Press the red square.
Oops.
The bird in the tree.
Perfect.
Equals 900.
Terrific!
It's expandable for all ages.
That's 10, 10.
He did it!
My Talking Computer is learning, cleverly disguised as fun. Clock modules sold separately.
And we're back. So, the host retro computing gift idea falls to me, and the choice I have made is the Lemon Clock Kit. So,
of course it is.
You know, it's a $8 toy. I'm linking to Amazon, but of course you can find, I'm sure you can find similar things other places. There's not much to say about this. You know, it's got a couple little probes and a little digital clock you can, and a picture of these probes stuck in a lemon. And that's about it.
We live in a weird world, where an $8 toy could mean this little lemon clock, or it could probably mean a Raspberry Pi with half a terabyte of storage.
Right.
It's bizarre how cheap some computers have gotten.
Right. And now back to our show. I guess, would anyone want to say anything further about the lemon clock?
Lemons.
Okay, thanks. Good. So now we can turn our attention to eBay. And yes, interesting. Okay, and Carrington, you have the first one.
Sure. Well, I am picking some ImageWriter 2 color ribbons. You might think, well, but those will all be dried up. Oh, no. Nay, 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 my friend. They are not, because they are newly made in January 2019. So somebody has started producing them. They produced a small batch and are now selling them on eBay. You can buy one or you can buy three. I picked this earlier today, and then I was listening to the Retro Maccast, and they talked about it as well. So I'm like, technically they scooped us. So if you've already heard about this on Retro Maccast, so did I. But I like the Retro Maccast. Everyone should listen to that. It's like the opposite of me. Like, they're calm, soft-spoken people talking about retro computers in a reasonable way. And I am bringing the pain. but this is cool. So it's an ImageWriter 4-color ribbon. I didn't have a lot of experience with these as a kid. I had an ImageWriter, ImageWriter 2. I really loved it. But I never did the color ribbon thing. And unlike a lot of color ribbons for typewriters that are normally black and red, these are 4-color ribbons. So you can do all fancy kind of color stuff with your 2GS or your Macintosh or whatever. Well, maybe not Macintosh. I don't know. Anyway, they exist. It's $35 for a pack of three. Or you can buy like a single one. I think for $15, so a bit of savings to get the 3-pack. And it's just cool that they're like not re-inked or whatever. They're newly manufactured ImageWriter 2 color ribbons. That's sweet.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. It's not entirely clear to me whether these are new made or last year new made. I think this is the same project. I got maybe like 5 of these or something. When this was first kind of announced. And it wasn't through eBay. There was someone on Facebook basically that was doing this, but I think it's probably the same set. And this is really nice. I know that when I was, in the day, I didn't really use the color printing because, I didn't want to waste the ribbon. So I wound up just probably drying out all my ribbons because I had never used them because I wanted to save them for something. So, and what you never want to do is print just black. I mean, like, you want to have a black ribbon that you can swap in if you're just going to be printing black, right? Because otherwise you run out, all your color.
Yep. And what's cool about the listing is it shows, like, obviously the product photo, like, here it is, ImageWriter ribbons, and here's the box they come in. But better than that, it's got 3 photos of big images printed out on tractor paper, and they're awesome, including one little picture of, like, a multicolored dinosaur that I totally love.
Yeah.
Frankly, I want to buy the dinosaur print.
Yeah, it's printing is super slow, but it's... cool. It really does not look too bad.
If you count in the time I spend trying to get modern printers to work at all, I don't know that modern printers are actually faster. Once they actually agree to begrudgingly stick a page and have it come out with your stuff, they're really quick. But the sometimes 1 hour, sometimes 1 week negotiation to actually get them to release the pages, if you factor that in, I don't know that printers have gotten any faster.
All right. Earl, you have an interesting tower here, too. A tower computer of a sort?
Tower of Earl.
This I found to be a really interesting auction. And before I talk too much about it, I want to ask, does anyone recognize this as having been covered in a previous RCR? Because the person who is conducting this auction here on eBay said... that this is a, by the way, I should talk about what it is first. This is a collection of 11 IBM PC 5150s and about 30 expansion cards in this group of, in this auction. And so have we talked about this before? Because they said this has been relisted a couple of times.
News to me.
Don't remember. Yeah.
I think I would remember a big old tower of these things, because that's what the first photo was, just a big tower of 5150s on top of each other.
Yeah,
giant,
I don't think I've
pile
seen
of 5150s. You have or have not?
I think I have not.
Okay, well, all right. So I found this to be intriguing. So the condition statement on the auction says not tested since removed from working environment in 2002, so 17 years ago. The cosmetic condition is fair. There's 11 5150s and 30 expansion cards, like I mentioned. A lot of them are tricked out up to 640K. They've got some Ethernet cards, just a variety of things. The price for this is a buy it now of $995 US and is a local pickup only.
Oh, mine lists international
in
shipping for $650.
Yeah, I have a $450 flat rate freight option.
Oh, that's
interesting. Imagine how heavy this is. Yeah.
So maybe they just don't ship
you,
to Oregon.
You, Earl, you're being catfished. Earl's got to come to the house. The rest of us,
no,
he's willing to ship to.
Well, I don't blame him. But in the in the auction description, it says local pickup. But you're right. Under shipping, I see an option for $450 flat rate. Of freight shipping. So anyway, yeah, you can get these shipped to you for $450.
Or not. A lot of times people mess up their auction, didn't realize it's like automatically including shipping or whatever. So I'd contact the seller to check.
Yeah, you know, I just, I don't know how to feel about this auction. I'm interested in what you guys' thoughts are. I mean, 5150s, they're starting to get a little bit more rare. Apparently, according to the description in the auction, if you scroll down, the condition of these, you know, it says the electronics inside all of them are in excellent condition. They were stored wrapped and indoors. They say, in fact, they were inside flight cases most of that time. And very low corrosion on the electronics, IC pins, connectors. And then, you know, there's a big description about some of the cards that are in here. Now, I don't think I would ever need 11 5150s. So if I were to buy something like this, the only reason I could think of to buy it would be for the express purpose of then taking each individual one, trying to test it and trick it out, and then resell it. And because what do you need 11 5150s for? That's kind of taking...
Two words for you, Beowulf cluster. since our listeners are all shouting that at their iPhones right now, I might as well just say it myself.
Indeed. If you want to do 8088 supercomputing, then this is definitely your pile of 5150s. What do you guys think about this?
Yeah. The price is such that I think you could make it back. I mean, like, if you wanted Agreed. To turn around and sell them and you don't value your time, then then you can make a profit. So, I mean, if you think it would be fun to set these up, I mean, it is true that probably no individual person would want 11 of them, and maybe you might want some of the cards that are in some of the things. And there, you know, actually, this does a pretty good job of describing every individual machine, what's in it, and you know, what the mm-hmm. case looks like, and that kind of thing. So, yeah, I could see this being the kind of thing where, you know, okay, maybe I can come away with the machine I want by, you know, selling the ones that I don't. And if I'm the seller, I could totally see this. Like, I just don't want to think about this anymore. I will get something for it. You can make a profit if you spend the time. At this point in my life, that's not an interesting thing for me to do. but I can sort of see some people might do it. I don't know.
What about you, Carrington? What do you think? Are you going to buy it?
No. I've always loved the case, the industrial design, like that massive heavy metal thing of the 5150 and the 5160. I don't know enough about early IBMs. In fact, I think the 5160 is the same thing with a hard drive built in, but like, and then the AT is the later one that I would prefer because it's 286, but I don't like the look of it as much. So because of that, I opt out of all of it.
I supported these in production. Some 5150s, but mostly the 5160s. And I actually do have one of my own. And I really do like them as well. I like the way they look. Mm-hmm. They are just, they're heavier than pure lead. I mean, to pick one of these suckers up, it's just amazing. And I've seen one dropped multiple feet onto concrete and picked up, dusted off, and working fine with no problems at all. So, yeah, they're really well constructed. It's just, you know, it was fascinating to me that somebody even had 11 of them. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know. I guess I'm guilty of not reading through carefully enough the entirety of the listing, because it actually is kind of a long listing. But I don't know the provenance of these. Like, how does someone wind up with 11? Were they working at a company where they were using the 5150s for a while, and then they... They do say, sorry, I'm opining when I don't need to. So they were originally at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo as AutoCAD workstations. And so the provenance is in here. And that's kind of what I expected, is that it had to be somebody who was there, and, you know, the machines were going to get gotten rid of, and so they just scooped them up. So
they were removed by me. Doesn't really say much more.
No, they're hot.
I wonder if we should check the newspapers in 2002 for, like, stories.
11 IBMs go missing. In 2019, I don't think anybody cares. So, actually, that That actually increases the coolness factor to me that they were used in an academic setting. I think that's pretty neat. But, man, wow, AutoCAD on a 5150, that sounds like pain. But anyway, I thought it was a really interesting listing. You don't often see a pile of this magnitude. So just thought I'd point it out. Apparently, there's only 6 days left, so I don't know if these will still be available at the time the show is published. And if they don't go this time, it says, the auction person says, if selling all as one lot doesn't work, then I'll split them up.
The issue there is just the shipping is so expensive for these things.
Yeah.
So maybe if like you or you had a few people locally who all want to get one, then this is a cheap way to do it. You pick them up and each of you takes two or whatever, then you resell a couple. Like there might be a way to make it work that way if you can get together with a few people in or near the same cities. BuzzFeed, that number 5 in the listing, says it's got a multifunction card with the RAM starts all full or whatever, and a leaky lithium battery. I'm like, well, deal with that battery, dude. Don't just say that it's leaking. So right.
It'd be interesting. I might actually bookmark this seller and see what happens if this listing doesn't go. It'd be kind of fascinating to see how these get pieced out and how that works out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, some of them are definitely in better shape than others. I mean, like, so once they get individually listed somewhere, most likely not going to sell so rapidly.
Well, and I'd have more interest if tested. You know, again, that's my crazy hang up is that, you know, you never know. I mean, there's 11 here, but you're kind of shooting the dice. I mean, all 11 might work just great, or maybe one or two work. I mean, these things have, the 5150s and 5160s have stood the test of time pretty well. The drives inside them, I'd be a little curious about. You know, those old Tandon drives, it'd be interesting to see if those work without some adjustment or maybe replacement of some of the different pieces inside. Anyway, be interesting to see how this goes. The seller has 100% positive feedback out of 2,148 auctions, so that's definitely a thing.
Hmm. So what do you got for us, Paul?
I have a few things. So,
excellent.
The first thing is, I've seen a few of these. This particular one is, you know, starting at very cheap. It's a Coleco My Talking Computer Learn for Fun system. And I think, so my understanding of this is not much different from just like a speak and spell, you know. So it has a couple little sort of games you can play on it that it talks to you and you solve, you know, math problems or various things.
I wasn't fooled as a kid by phrases like learn for fun, and I'm not going to be fooled now.
Right. I think that the device is actually kind of interesting in that it has, so unlike the speak and spell, it has this sort of, it's almost like cartridges probably is cartridges, or almost like discs or something. You get these little programs that you slot in to a spot for them. And then there are little
overlays.
And then
like an overlay, yeah. So kind of an Intellivision system that way.
Yeah.
You plug in a cart on the side with a weird little slanty cart shape too, and then put a different overlay on front. So that's kind of neat. I don't think I've ever seen one of these things before.
So maybe that's it, actually, you know, to make it seem even more like fun. It's fun to play the, you know, the Intellivision or the
and
Atari 86, or whatever.
So was the ColecoVision out by then? Are they trading on the Coleco? I got you a Coleco. Yay! Hey, what is this? What is this nonsense, Mom?
Right. But so this particular auction, I mean, it's not super expensive, but it has a lot of the pieces. Like, you know, not all these pieces, I think, came together. So you get at least, I think, 3 different little cartridges and the manuals for everything. And there's a separate expansion module that came with something. I don't know. But anyway, I thought it was neat. I don't know if I don't have one. I'm not sure that I will, but it's an interesting object at any rate.
Also, I just checked, and ColecoVision came out 4 years before this.
Okay.
So 3 years of wrecking people's Christmases.
Right. Next thing is the It's a Backpack 100, which is, again, this is, I'm less promoting this as a thing to buy and more as a interesting thing that existed, but it's a 100 megabyte hard drive that you stick on the back of your Macintosh Plus. So it just sort of like...
I remember these.
Yeah, it sort of like sticks on there, like it plugs into the power plug and then has a power plug of its own that it transmits, you know, through. So it's kind of like a hidden hard drive.
Mm-hmm. And the funny thing is, so many people would use hard drives or stands or whatever to lift a Plus and an SE, like that form factor, to lift it up off the desk because it's relatively low. So ergonomically, a lot of times you want to lift it higher. And a hard drive was great for that. And so this is like, no, we're keeping it low and you're going to stick the hard drive in the back.
Right.
but I want to lift it up. Get a stand.
Yeah. Yeah, I do remember there was some sort of interference between like the keyboard and like the stuff I had around the keyboard and the disk drive. On the Mac, you know, it would have been nice for it to be up a little bit higher so that I wouldn't have to move everything to put disks in and out.
Safer against spills and stuff, too.
Yeah, true. Anyway, so if you are interested in the existence of this thing and have a different stand, then it's true. I haven't seen many of these. I mean, I had come across them before. It's a Jasmine Technologies Inc. drive. And it says it's specifically for the Mac Plus, so perhaps only for that model. I suppose it does have to fit at least where the power things are, because it really attaches right to the back. The next thing I have is a vintage Telerom Portabubble 81, which I could not. I mean, like, I love the name. It's a terminal of some kind, but. How can you not want a Telerom Portabubble?
I want this thing regardless of the name, although I agree that is an amazingly cool name. But look at this. It's a beautiful keyboard. It's a great form factor. It packs up into a little suitcase so you can take it with you. It's got a cute tiny little screen over there. And, you know, and who doesn't need an acoustic coupler on top?
Right.
I mean, yeah, exactly. This is your best post-apocalyptic terminal, by the way, because it's got everything. You can just pick it up and take it with you. This is just gorgeous.
Three different color keys on the keyboard.
Exactly.
And a little spot on the right to set your, I don't know what, pack of cigarettes or something.
What is that thing? Like, there's a slot that's not like for anything. It's just a gouge out of the case, like on purpose. That what would go there? I love it. Also, yeah. Portabubble. I just want it because it's called a Portabubble.
Yep. I see. It's portable, but then, you know, with some sort of speech impediment, it becomes.
So I don't understand this. It has been tested and works. The word processor functions, and we were able to save files and find them in the directory. Directory of what?
Yeah.
Does it have some like little storage built into it or something? What did they mean by that? I wonder.
That is interesting. I guess maybe it does. I mean, they certainly are. There's some non-random garbage on the screen.
It can't be a built-in hard drive from 81. How much was this thing?
I mean, I think it is supposed to be like somewhere in the description. I think it talks about this being common for like journalists and stuff. You know, that it was a way to submit your stories. Yes. This example was used by a daily newspaper in a bureau office.
I wonder if there's still stories on it. You can break some news that never got out. Maybe they were sued because these things are so heavy they couldn't legally call it portable. So, well, we could call it Portabubble.
Right.
Heavily implies portable. It's the natural flavor of portables.
So 5,395 is what you would have paid for it.
No, it's what they would have been asking for. I wouldn't have paid anything.
I'm looking on Terminals Wiki, and
as one does.
Introduced April of 81. Introductory price $5,395. Not finding much more information about it, but there's a link off to an old Computer World article here. So interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think this has got to be some sort of internal storage, though, because like there's no phone in the acoustic coupler. So it's not like they have called someplace. That hadn't occurred to me. I wonder to what extent this is going to work, you know, in a year.
Well, now here's the funny thing, is that the pictures that I'm seeing on terminalswiki.org are the same pictures that I'm seeing in the eBay auction.
Well, that is a funny thing. That could mean one of two things. Either this is a not very fully honest listing, or that actually is the one that's being sold.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, the pictures say from eBay item, etc. So it turns out this is the one that's being sold.
It's so rare there are no other photos.
Right, so yeah, the terminal's exactly. Wiki grabbed it. That's cool.
Yep.
That's neat. Anyway, it does seem like it would be kind of a fun thing to play around with. It is a starting bid of $400, basically 6 days left as we record. It's in Olympia, Washington, so maybe... And it would cost $61 to ship to me, but presumably, Earl, you could get it for less.
Yeah, I could drive up. I don't think I'm going to, but, you know, I'm not saying 100% that I won't, because this is awesome.
Actually, before we go on, the whole time we've been talking about this, I've also been looking online at photos of the Jasmine hard drives, because you said that backpack thing was made by Jasmine, which rang a bell. Jasmine drives, they made a thing called the Direct Drive, and I think those, look at the photo, I'm like, I remember these. Back when my family had a big old printing company, the first hard drives we put in to act as kind of central hard drives were these Jasmine drives, which were kind of famous because they were so much cheaper than other drives you could get, and yet how we got them was we bought them used from like the U.S. partner we had. So they had used them for like a year or something, then we're upgrading. So we bought their used hard drives, and like the first big hard drive purchase we made was to put a bunch of these. Like I think they were like either 80 or 160 megabyte drives. And nothing like just putting all your company's production on a bunch of used hard drives you just had shipped up. Like, it's remarkable the choices I once made. It all worked out fine for us, but I'm like, wow, I would be afraid to do that now.
Yeah, and the next thing I would think is actually maybe all that interesting, but for some reason it caught my attention that the title, it says Canadian Computer History, Dasco Word Processing Catalog, 1979-1980. It is a Canadian company. There are word processors in their computers that I am not familiar with, and amusing photos of people behind very large machines. But
all still very popular in Canada. I will admit.
If you have some nostalgic connection to Dasco Office Supplies or whatever this is, Dasco Word Processing Limited. Anyway, whatever. It's mildly interesting, but it's just a catalog, and it was less interesting than I'd hoped it would be. Unless Carrington, you have some recollection of Dasco things.
Absolutely. No, I don't. I have recollection of early word processing systems and paste up and all that kind of stuff. But what I like about this is the cover photo, because it shows a desk, and it's a thing you don't really see anymore. It's the kind of desk where it's made to look like it's just like particle board. They put a vinyl over it, whatever, that looks like hardwood. But more importantly, like the printer's on one part of the desk and the computer's on another part. And it's from that era where there would be a lower part of the desk. So the desk steps down a couple of inches because computers are so thick and heavy, your computer part of your desk is going to have a lower part. And then later than this, things, you know, computers started having separate keyboards. You get keyboard trays, a thing I always hated. But this is from that weird era where furniture would come out with a lower portion because then that would put the keyboard at an intelligent height in a sense. So I like it. I like that era of desks.
This is also the era where you computed with a single rose next to your computer.
As one would, as I would now.
Yeah, the images are funny and interesting. And realistic, I suppose, to a certain extent. I mean, you know, I'm not sure about the rose, but that is office furniture, and those are computers. That's a weird-looking computer, actually. It's sort of pet-like, but not quite.
Yep, it looks like a fake pet. It was 3D rendered, just like the other one we were talking about.
Right.
Some computers just look fake.
Okay, so then the next thing. I'm glad you're here, Earl. You can tell us something
Me
about
too,
this,
Earl.
Maybe. I mean, yes, generally speaking, I am glad you are here. But also for this particular
thanks,
item.
Guys.
So this is Sci-Fi Man in, where he is, Nova Scotia. So
Yay.
This is a seller who shows up, you know, relatively frequently in these... eBay sections. This is a ultra rare prototype Commodore 264 computer, tested, working, pristine, and the starting bid is $15,000. And the recommendation is that you fly out and get it. If you can afford that, you can afford to fly out and get it. He does not want to ship it. And also, you might not want to, after flying out and getting it, put it in, you know, the regular luggage section. Right. Because that may not be any better than shipping. But yeah, so this, from what I understand from the listing, it was either never actually released or it was possibly given to a few developers. It preceded the Plus 4, but is not the same as the Plus 4 inside. The case looks almost identical to the Plus 4. And so I don't know, that's about what I know about it. Do you know any other things about it, Earl?
I don't. I'm actually not real qualified to talk about the 264.
I'm no longer glad you're here, Earl. Earn your keep.
I know. Am I going to get fired? Ultra rare prototype Commodore 264. And they even say in the listing that it's rarer than the Commodore 65, which these days has kind of lapsed into unobtainium and has similar prices. So, now, fascinating. I'd have to do my homework a little bit on this. And I think with a listing of this magnitude, you know, it'd be interesting to find out. Where is this located, by the way?
Nova Scotia.
Oh, Nova Scotia, up in Canada. Oh, that's fascinating. I got nothing.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, so the seller is someone that we've been talking about for a couple months, probably. I don't know anything about the story of the seller, but clearly, this is a collector going through a collection and downsizing or getting rid of it. So there's a lot of sort of interesting, you know, it's a curated collection. This isn't just something someone found in the
basement. Looking at other things this person has for sale, like this Robotron KC-87. I'm like, what the heck is this? A lot of weird things.
Data watch for the Commodore 64 almost made it into my list. Oh, and in fact, actually, the ultra-rare Backpack 100 Jasmine Drive for the Mac Plus is the same seller. But yeah, so I learned a little bit about this on Facebook in a conversation thread, but it seemed like, from what I understand, the 264 did not, you know, it did get sent out, but only to a few people. The 65 was a little bit more well released. In that conversation, it was, you know, in the Facebook thread, it was suggested that this is not a computer anyone would actually want. You know, like, I mean, it is rare, you know, it's sort of like a Plus 4 without the built-in software.
Yeah, I'm trying to imagine the target market for this at $15,000. I mean, I can kind of understand the target market for the Commodore 65 being...
If you're a Commodore completionist, then that's the market. Like, you don't have it to use it, you have it to have it.
It's got to be a small group of people. I mean, at this level, you know, again, with the 65, it was the last gasp of, you know, Commodore and the 8-bit-ish world, you know, and so I can kind of understand that. I'm not sure I understand who's going to drop $15,000 on this particular computer. It'd be interesting to see how this auction plays out.
Yeah.
Next episode, Jack will show up. Well, I bought it.
My guess is it will not sell, but at least it will be known. If somebody really is looking for one of these, they may find this person in some other way.
Looking at this seller, it's so interesting how you can kind of get a sense of who someone is, because he's got all these collectible and obscure vintage computer things, and then also a whole bunch of Buck Rogers models.
Yeah, right.
I dig it.
Now, one thing to point out, the seller does say, "I will consider any serious offer." So,
that's true. This is one of those that
they do have a make offer button.
So I guess you could consider the $15,000 as being, I don't know, not even a order of magnitude estimate, but, you know, sort of an idea that this is not your $75, you know, Plus 4. Anyway, okay. Last thing. What was the last thing? Oh yeah, I just thought this was, I don't know why I picked this, but it's a book called How to Build Your Own working 16-bit microcomputer. And the sort of subtitle says, everything you need to know to use the new super advanced TI-9900 CPU single chip processor. And, you know, so I thought it's just kind of an interesting little project book from the past. It might be sort of interesting to read. It's, you know, it's a $15 buy it now book. It's, you know, as always with books, it's quite possible that if you searched around at this place that starts with A, you might find it cheaper, but, you know, this is not that
duck,
much either.
The controversial name. I mean, get them on the phone.
Gift books. Anyway, yeah. So I thought it was interesting. I can't specifically recommend the book, but it just, you know, it's interesting that it talks about the 9900 CPU being this, like, you know, new advanced 16-bit wonder chip.
Mm-hmm.
This is your way in. The book covers every type of interface required, enabling you to solve whatever problems you may encounter. So this is very broad claims.
Well, so this sounded familiar to me. So I used Google as my friend and found out that this was the heart of a computer that a series of computers actually from TI in the 70s and 80s called the TI-990. And so I guess that would put it as a predecessor to the 99/4. I don't remember what processor the 99/4A used, but I thought it was basically internally a 16-bit processor, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I mean, I had, all the way up until this second, assumed that that was the chip inside the 99/4A, but let us see what Wikipedia says, because Wikipedia is the source of all knowledge.
Oh, it says the 99/4A has a 16-bit TMS 9900 CPU. But before that, there was that previous version, the TI-990 series.
Okay. I think that is all I had in my list. So now I guess we can move to closing discussions. And Carrington, you have the first thing.
I got more videos. It's all video like this time. So every once in a while you find something on YouTube or whatever that I think is really fascinating and would be of interest to our listeners. So there is a YouTube channel called Nibbles and Bytes. But Nibbles is with a Y, just like Bytes is. And it's really interesting. So the host is an embedded software engineer, and I don't know her name. I think it's June Tate Gans. Okay. I'm not really aware of her, except she's somebody who is an embedded software engineer and has written a game called Minimalist Dungeon. It's a modern game. But she's been a fan of like old computers because she grew up in like with a Commodore. So she acquired a Commodore 128D and said, okay, now that I got it working, well, what do I do with it? And what she's decided to do is backport her game. So the game she had created, this Minimalist Dungeon, had a real 8-bit feel. So she thought, well, it's the kind of game that would run great on a vintage computer. So why don't I learn how to program for the Commodore 128 and port my game to release it on the Commodore 128 and videotape the whole process of going through this. So it's really interesting because it's somebody who's like, a lot of times you see retro stuff and retro YouTube channels and they're just like, isn't this a pretty computer? Or they play games or whatever. And this is somebody who's approaching it from a writing software engineering standpoint. So, you know, much heavier, dense info. I was hooked immediately. And I don't even like the Commodore. And so as an Apple guy, I was immediately hooked on her channel. So I want to give a shout out to it. I think we should have a link in the show notes. If you want to watch a game get ported from like a 1928 game or a 2018 game get ported to the 128 and follow her through the process as she learns more about the hardware and how to write the game. And the whole thing is really fascinating. So there's like 3 or 4 episodes out now. It comes out every 2 weeks and I really like it. So if you like the Commodore or you just like vintage computer programming, this looks like a channel that you should check out.
I'm with Carrington on this one. I'm subscribed to this. I've started watching through the videos and everything he said, plus one of the coolest things, I actually do like Commodore, as you guys might know. and the Commodore 128D, I think, is like the ultimate 8-bit computer of ever. So watching that be the focus of these videos is particularly cool for me. So, yeah, this is great. You should watch it. You should subscribe to it. Absolutely.
Yeah, I had not come across this.
It was only the last couple of weeks I somehow YouTube actually recommended something I might actually be interested in. I said, oh, hey, this is awesome. I just really liked the presentation. I really like that she knows a whole bunch, but is also kind of learning as she goes. And just, yeah, I dig it a lot. A strong recommend.
All right. Any final thoughts from you, Earl?
No, that'll do it for me.
All right. Yeah, and I'm also looking at this empty space on the show notes, and I'm not sure what I would say either. I don't know. All right. That's okay. We need not always have closing thoughts.
Yeah.
Or any thoughts at all.
That's right.
Yeah, land the plane, Paul. All right. It's all you.
Here we go. Prepare. Tray tables up. Feedback is forward. That's it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at RCR Podcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/RCR Podcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com, and we are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.com at a link in the show notes. Write a review on iTunes if you want, or don't. And until next time,
Retro Compute!
Powered by Lemons!
Right.
Okay, but what if your computer was run by Meadowlark Lemon from the Harlem Globetrotters? So there's lots count? Of ways to power things by lemons. You just got to get a little creative about what you mean by for certain definitions of lemon.
Right.